Writers, KJ here. Have you heard me talk about Dabble yet? I mean, really listened? Dabble Writing Software is our new sponsor, and we love them. Serena and I can't stop playing with the outline piece of it, which is every bit as flexible as a bunch of post-it notes on your desk and a whole lot more portable. You can track everything that belongs within a scene, how that scene fits into multiple plot lines, and where that scene belongs in the book, and you can move it with the flick of a mouse. It's honestly a little too much fun. We don't want to encourage you to procrastinate, but getting your storyline right isn't procrastination, right? It's part of the work. So try out Dabble and let us know if it helps you get your work done by downloading a free trial at dabblewriter.com.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now, 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Hi, welcome to the hashtag AmWriting Podcast. We are coming to you today with Serena Bowen and myself, Jess Leahy. I am so excited today. I'm doing a slightly different intro because KJ usually handles the intro today, but today I get to be the superstar intro person. This is the podcast where we talk about all the things writing. We talk about proposals. We talk about querying. We talk about agents. We talk about pub dates. We talk about all the weird stuff that's going on in the world right now that affects writers. And most of all, what we talk about is getting the work done. I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the forthcoming The Addiction Inoculation that'll be out in April. And I write currently for The Washington Post and have a few pieces coming out in a really cool little publication called Airmail.
And I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 30-odd romance novels published in about 15 or 16 languages. And you can find more about me at serenabowen.com.
Today's guest is a repeat guest, and we don't do that very often. And the reason we are doing a repeat today is because this person teaches me so much every single time I talk to him. I talk a lot on this podcast about people who have been real role models for me in terms of generosity and kindness. I know I've talked about A.J. Jacobs in the past. He's someone that every time someone reaches out as a new writer for advice, I'm kind of tempted to say, oh, I just don't have time for that right now. I think, wait a second, what would AJ do? And then I usually get back to that person. And our guest today is another one of those people for me. Seth Godin is with us today. I was introduced to him a long time ago through a mutual friend, another generous writer, by the way. And I'm really grateful because not only is Seth an entrepreneur and all the stuff you've heard about him is true, he's a whiz bang entrepreneur. He's in the marketing and direct marketing hall of fame. He's written 19 best-selling books that we have talked about a fair amount, my personal favorites, just because of what's in them and when they came to me and the advice that meant a lot to me when the book landed in my lap, is Purple Cow and What Are You Going to Do With That Duck and All Marketers Tell Stories. They really affect the way I think about my work. The cool thing is that to me, actually, foremost for me, Seth is a teacher. And that's what I'm hoping he can be for us today, because he's here to talk about his new book, The Practice: Shipping Creative Work. Welcome back, Seth. I'm so happy you're here.
Oh, you're so kind. What a lovely introduction. And it's good to talk to you again. and it's good to meet Serena as well. And Serena, as far as I can tell, only two of your romance novels are odd. The rest of them are straight up the middle and fantastic.
He went for it, Serena. He went for the joke. I told you, every time you do the odd thing, I'm so tempted for it. And we try so hard. We do. We do try so hard around here. So we have had a chance to read the book, and there's so much to talk about. I think the big points that this book makes that I really want to make sure we hit today have to do with... I guess the big ones for me really have to do with creativity not being some innate talent, but a skill that can be built. And that's something we talk a lot about on this podcast. We definitely talk about the question of whether or not writer's block exists, and sometimes we disagree about that. And then I really want to make sure we hit on a point you make in this book that has to do with sort of the genesis of criticism and where it comes from, because, I have a book coming out in April that scares the heck out of me because I thought I'd be writing this straightforward nonfiction research-based book. And instead, what I ended up with is a research-based book that's also largely a memoir. And I said a lot of stuff there that really scares me. And Serena is incredibly good at this, too. The stuff that she writes sometimes is the best stuff she writes is sometimes the scariest stuff. So could we talk a little bit about where this book came from for you? And, you know, you've written so many great things. So where in sort of the pantheon of Seth books does this book happen for you? Why this book?
I think it's a capstone. It came out of the years of developing the Creators Workshop and then watching how hundreds of people interacted with the ideas in real time. There's a big difference, particularly for people who work in self-help and nonfiction. There's a big difference between somebody knowing what to do and someone doing it. And what the internet has done is given us, among many things, a manual about how to do things, and yet few people do them. And the reason for the gap, the knowing-doing gap, is that we don't trust ourselves. And we are confused by centuries of brainwashing and indoctrination about the fact that it's not our turn, that we are not touched by the gifts and the talents that we need, that it is reserved for other people, probably elites, and that we should just do what we're told, that we are pushed to fear criticism and we are pushed to copy. And so with all that mythology out there, we get stuck. And I find that that stuckness is corrosive, because if you believe that you have a way to make things better and you are afraid to do so, it can eat you up.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot there.
So could I make a suggestion that we hit upon the amazing subtitle of this book for a moment? Because one of the first things the book handles is explaining this subtitle. And I believe that it speaks to everything that Seth just said. So the subtitle of the book is Shipping Creative Work. Three words, and I'm curious, was it difficult or easy to land on those exact three words?
So that's sort of a marketing question, and sometimes I get it right and sometimes I don't. All Marketers Are Liars, which is one of my best books, has the worst title of any business book ever written. So I can get it wrong as often as I get it right. Shipping.
See, and I called it All Marketers Tell Stories because that's the way that book speaks to me.
Well, because that's the new title. We figured out a way to change the title without changing the title. Shipping, because if it doesn't ship, it doesn't count. You're allowed to have hobbies. I like hobbies. But if you don't ship the work to the public, you have a hobby. Professionals ship the work to the public. Creative, because if you have a decent job, your job is not doing what you're told. Your job is not coloring inside the lines, being a cog in the machine. Because I got to tell you, GPT-3 can write just as well as you if all you're doing is following instructions. And work, because it's work. And no one gets plumber's block and no one gets talker's block. Writer's block is completely invented. It is simply work. And if we can acknowledge that we have work to do, and that we can ship it and that it can be creative, which means that it might not work, then we get a chance to get to our practice. So that's how I decoded the subtitle.
So a friend of mine this week had a really interesting problem in that she got a call she has an agent. She got an interest from an editor for a book that I happen to think really needs to be written. I think it will speak to a lot of people. And she had the gatekeeper problem where she was told that her platform isn't big enough. So she wants to ship in one way. So if she comes to you and she says, look, Seth, this is all well and good, ship, ship, ship. I would love to ship this thing, but people are keeping me from shipping it. What's a great answer for someone like that?
No one is entitled to an audience. No one is entitled to a publisher either. And if I was a publisher, I would make my last resort being looking for amazing ideas from people no one had ever heard of. Because in today's world, being heard of and having a following is easier than ever before. Most of the people who have a following have nothing to say. And so the commercial considerations that this editor is honestly sharing with her are real. And if you're running a commercial enterprise, I totally get it. That has nothing to do with this woman needing to ship creative work, because what we've done in music, in video, in books, is dismantled the gatekeeping system largely. So, you know, before we got on this call, we were talking about the publishing industry, but the publishing industry is really different right now than the reading industry, because on the Kindle, there are, what, 20 times as many books published as are published by New York City now? And what that means is if you want to publish your book, no one can stop you. It probably won't be commercially successful, but you can ship it. And what I would say is, are there 10 people who will, because you asked them to, read it? And if you hand it to 10 people and they say, thank you very much, and that's the end of it, then whatever you wrote could have been better. But if you hand it to 10 people and they can't go to bed until they tell 10 more people, now you're up to 100, and then you're up to 1,000. And the next thing you know, you have that platform the editor was looking for. So the answer is not to get hooked on the outcome, becoming attached to commercial success. That's not what I'm pitching. What I'm pitching is you need to ship it to someone who might not like it. You need to put it into a place where it might not work, because that's the only way to know if you're onto something.
We have, of course, on the podcast with us today, Serena Bowen, who overcame her gatekeeper problem by making a whole new gate, which, you know, that is working for her beautifully. You know, so there are ways around that. It's just, you know, I think what stops a lot of people is, oh, you know, I have these things to say, but I just can't get them out in the world because no one is giving me a bullhorn. And I guess what I'm getting from you is it doesn't matter if it's bullhorn, if it's, you know, a few people listening here and there, you have to at least get it out there so that it can be considered in the first place.
Yeah, it's really important to want to be on the hook. And if an editor picks your book and a publishing house publishes your book, to many extents, you're not on the hook. They made a commercial decision. They're grown-ups. They have to figure out how to sell the book. If, you know, we looked at the explosion of podcasting over the last 10 years, but almost no one has a podcast, even though you can have a podcast for free. There was an explosion of blogs, but almost no one still has a blog, even though you can have a blog for free. And the reason is, if you do these things for free, it feels a little icky, perhaps. It puts you on the hook. It eliminates all the excuses of being picked, because if you want to publish, publish. And that is where the future of culture is being defined, by people who are choosing to publish.
I mean, I as someone who got her break because just a couple of people stumbled on some blog posts that I think my readers at that point were like my mother and a few teachers at the same school where I taught wanting to get mad at me about some of the things I was saying. That's sort of where it started for me. And I think that was also the part that was interesting about that is I also kind of assumed that the stuff that I was saying wouldn't be that interesting to a huge number of people. And I was sort of happy to be found wrong. But I think that's also one of the reasons that, and you mentioned this later on in the sort of the creativity section of the book, you talk about these smallest visible breakthroughs. And for me, that was a small but very visible breakthrough, which was writing about the things that lit me up from inside, as opposed to the things that I thought the gatekeepers would want to hear. So I get that. And I do understand that. But I also understand the frustration of a lot of authors who are like, look, I do want to ship this stuff. I need people to help me ship it. I can't, my hands are tied until someone else will let me ship it, which is why I love what Serena has done, which is to, you know, say, well, forget that. I'm just going to ship it myself.
Yeah. And just for avoidance of doubt, if you can get a great deal from a New York City book publisher, please do. And the support and the insight that you're going to get from that institution is really precious. And it's not fair. It's not fair for the people who get it. It's not fair for the people who don't get it. But that happened. Now what are you going to do about it? And what I am arguing is, if you want to write, write. That if you can listen to this, there is nothing keeping you from writing. There may be a lot keeping you from making a living doing it, but every podcast that ever launched, launched with only one listener. And everything that's ever been written was written for the first time for one reader. And then it goes, and then it goes, and then it goes. And so what I'm trying to do here is describe laws of physics that are associated with creativity. And one of the laws of physics is that, unlike 1960, you can no longer make the argument that your creative work is forced to be invisible.
Right. So I really love the use of the word ship because I'm a very practical person, and I was right there with you with the first word in the subtitle, and I'm an excellent shipper. Where I'm hitting roadblocks lately is in the complete opposite direction, which is that I do now have an audience that is substantial, and I find that my own audience expectations are now the biggest inhibition to my new creative work, because I write a chapter of a new thing, or yesterday I spent all day working on marketing for a book that I hope some people read, and I can open up Instagram and I will have been tagged in many messages celebrating something I wrote 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's that constant feedback in my head of what people are expecting from me, and why couldn't I just write a third book about those people, please, and just, you know.
Right.
But of course I'm not going to.
Okay, so there's so much juiciness here. Thank you for bringing this up. The first thing I want to talk about is Nike and the fact that just ship it is not what I'm talking about. Because when people usually use the word just, they mean what the hell. Just get it over with. Crap, whatever. Put it out there. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about merely ship it. And what merely ship it means, simply ship it means, is do it without drama, do it without recrimination, do it without getting yourself all hung up on how fraught this moment is. Because all of that is not making your work better. That perfectionism has nothing to do with perfect. Perfectionism is a form of hiding. So with that said, now we have to make a choice if we're in the commercial space, which the three of us are. And the choice is, should we be a hack or should we be an artist? And is it possible to be an artist and a professional at the same time that we are serving an audience? So let me tell you what I mean by a hack. I do not mean it as a negative. I mean it as an accurate description of what you do. Now, Hackney is a borough of London that, when London was small, was on the outskirts. And they raised horses there. They didn't raise thoroughbreds. They raised everyday horses at an everyday price. And that's what they used to pull the cabs, which is why London cab drivers are called hacks. And if you need a pretty good horse at a pretty good price, you should buy one from someone who makes pretty good horses at a pretty good price, not go to Kentucky and get some horse that's related to a Kentucky Derby winner. Well, if you want to make, I don't know, a cookbook a month, month after month after month, you need to give the audience exactly what it wants. And the audience will pay you for that. And so you're a hack cookbook writer, and there's nothing wrong with that. You should be proud of it. You do it for a living, the same way the person who fixed my furnace does it for a living. At the other extreme is the diva, who is of either gender, who is stuck because no one is good enough to be in that person's audience. And they demand perfection. You know, this is when Keith Jarrett will walk off the stage at Carnegie Hall because someone in the audience coughed, right? That becoming a diva means you're only making the work for yourself and you refuse to extend yourself to the audience at all. And in between is this magic zone. This is where Neil Gaiman lives, and this is where Spike Lee lives. This is the zone where you are giving the audience something it wants, but they didn't know they wanted it until you brought it to them. And that's scary, because who knows if you're going to be right or wrong. And if you want to be one of those artists, what you need to do is train your audience, the true fans in your audience, to not expect a greatest hits record every time. So if we think about what Joni Mitchell did, Joni Mitchell took a deep breath when she came out with Don Juan's Reckless Daughter, and she made an album that some of her fans saw as a breakthrough and that led many of her other fans to just walk away. But that was a privilege she had because she had earned fans, and she realized she could do fine with the fans who wanted what she was going to make next. And so, Serena, you have this fork in the road. One choice is to say, this kind of audience really likes what they like, and commercially, I'm just going to keep making it for them. And I think James Patterson has done that. Or you can, I don't know, invent a pseudonym and start writing books under another name for a new audience where you're experimenting. Or you could train the audience you've got that if you buy a Serena book, it might be different this time, because that's what you get when you get a book from Serena.
Yeah, and I have up to a point done that last thing. And when I think about what kind of creator I am, I love the diva versus hack idea. And I often end up at the metaphor of being a chef.
Mm-hmm.
Each time I'm trying to create a fine meal, and hopefully there's something about it that's a little bit unforgettable. But at the same time, you're still going to eat it and, you know, put down your napkin and walk away.
Right. But you don't want to be a cook. You want to be a chef. And there's a big difference.
But I also don't need to be a sculptor. Like, you don't have to take my work home and put it in the middle of your living room and stare at it every single day. You know, like, you can be finished with it and, you know, pay the check and it doesn't have to change your life necessarily. And when I look at things that way, I feel better, because I feel like that's a deliverable I can, you know, let I can accomplish.
Whereas if I sit here and think
in a minute we're going to get to imposter syndrome, but I want to jump in before we move on, which is, I want to talk about the Mona Lisa. I want to talk about sculptors, because if someone puts a sculpture in their house, it does not change their life after they put it in their house. When they look at it, they are remembering what it felt like to look at it for the first time.
And, or to acquire it.
Or to acquire it.
Often.
And so, Serena, if your book is on my bookshelf or on my Kindle, the same thing is true. That I have bookshelves here. Why? I already read all these books. I have bookshelves here because looking at the spine reminds me of how I felt when I read the book. So yeah, you're a sculptor. Sorry.
Actually, one of my favorite quotes in your book is from a sculptor. It's the Elizabeth King quote, which was, quote, "Process saves us from the poverty of our intentions." And I adore that quote. I think for a lot of us, we get stuck in the intention piece of it, which is, oh, it has to be perfect, or, oh, it has to be, you know, I have to be writing like David Foster Wallace today, or I'm falling short of my intentions. But that process really is what saves us. That's what saves me every single day, because I can't let that intention stop me from doing the work and from shipping the work, as you said.
Exactly. She changed my life. I came across that quote early in working on the book. And I wanted to see who said it. And it turns out, if you search on the internet, 5 people say they said it. And I tracked down the person who was saying it the most loudly, and he confessed that he had heard it from her. And then I tracked her down, which wasn't easy, and we're now friends. And the documentary that's on Amazon Prime about her is mind-blowing, absolutely mind-blowing. Yeah. Work that she does is stunning. And I won't spoil it by telling you what work she sculpts, but it's stunning. And her output is tiny, like tiny, but her process is supreme. And it guides her life forward, merely doing the work. She's not beating herself up at how fast she makes things. She merely does it. The process is there, day after day, without a scolding voice in her head, because the scolding doesn't make the work better.
Yeah. It was funny when I hit on another bit in your book where you talk about creativity being an act of leadership, and it really hit close to home, because we had Julie Lithcott-Hames, a friend, an author, on the podcast recently, and there was a quote that hit one of our listeners really hard, which was that memoir is an act of service. And this person recently finished her book, and she admitted that while she was trying to finish the book, she had that quote, "the memoir is an act of service," on a post-it in front of her the entire time, because it reminded her of what it was she was trying to do with this book. And that creativity as an act of leadership, I think the reason I like that quote so much is that it reminds me that if I want to do something that is going to rally people, that is going to make people want to follow what I do, I have to be more creative. I can't just do what we were talking about before, which is just keep sort of feeding people the same thing over and over again. That creativity is an important part of the leadership picture.
This is fantastic. And we can decode this into as we walk into the discussion of criticism. Because if you're a stand-up comic and you do a great set and no one laughs, it's easy to get angry at the audience. But then if you find out that everyone in the audience only speaks Italian, you let the audience and yourself off the hook. Because, of course, they didn't laugh. They didn't understand a word you were saying. So if we're truly doing an act of service, not acting like a toddler and demanding the world look at us, but doing this work because it's going to turn on a light for somebody, and then someone criticizes us, we need to understand that there's one of maybe three kinds of things we're hearing. One of them, which might be coming to Jessica soon, is people want to protect you. And they are afraid for you. And so they are telling you to get a day job or telling you not to go to an edge or telling you not to be as transformative or transparent as you want because they're afraid for you. And it's nice to be told that they love you, but maybe you should ignore that. The second kind of criticism, which is super scarce and super rare and why Nikki Papadopoulos is my hero, is when a professional, for money or not for money, gives you actual useful constructive advice on how to achieve your goals better. And if you're someone who builds bridges for a living, you're eager to get that because you just don't want that bridge to fall down. And math is math. And the third kind of criticism, which is the kind most of us get most of the time, can be translated as, this wasn't for me. And our response is, thank you. Thank you for identifying that you shouldn't waste any more of your time on my work, and I shouldn't waste any of my more of my time on you. Because we're not in the same place. It's totally cool. Thank you. But it's not personal. Because like if you're into the World Wrestling Federation and you accidentally read one of my books because you think it's about practicing wrestling, you're not going to like it. And I will not be offended that you didn't like it because I didn't write it for you. So what we can do is open ourselves up to the second kind of criticism and refuse to hear the other two kinds.
Well, on the flip side of that, you talk in the book also about avoiding reassurance, which is something that only recently I've sort of been thinking about a lot, which is that if I am only getting reassurance, I'm not growing. And I'm certainly around people who may or may not be telling me the truth, because there's absolutely no reason that people should always agree with everything I do. And so I'm not around people who are helping me grow if I'm only getting reassurance. So I like both sides of that. And I also like the fact that you encourage people in this book to do a little dance with fear. And that fear has to do with, you know, giving people something that maybe is unexpected or not what they want. And yet I have to say, every time Serena has done that, every time Serena has texted me and said, we have this little three-way text. It's me, it's KJ, it's Serena. We text each other all day long. And I specifically remember the texts I got from her when she was going to try something new with her books. And I remember one in particular that was a gay romance. It was going to be her first gay romance. And she was like, guys, I am scared to death about this one. I don't know what my audience is going to think. And that book went on to, I think it's one of her best books. And the reason that it's one of her best books is that she went places that forced her to be more creative and to be more honest and to be more authentic, which was really fun to watch, because then I can turn around and use that example to make me be more brave and to not and to go out into places that are a little bit scary for me too. Sorry, Serena, didn't mean to, you know, pretend like you're not here and just stroke your
ego.
It's
super hard because we're not, and there is no here. I want to decode reassurance, because this is the most controversial sentence in the book as far as the people who are my friends tell me, which is my statement, reassurance is futile, means that all reassurance about future events is false. Not only is it false, there is never enough of it. That if you got a call and it was Oprah herself telling you how much she loved the last thing you wrote, within a day, you would hit a new roadblock and you would need her to call you again. Because there is never enough reassurance from outsiders to take us to a place in the future where we are sure it's going to work. Because if it's art, we can't be sure it's going to work. And so someone can say, I read your book, I really liked it. That's a true statement about today. But if someone says, I read your book and everything's going to be okay, or I read your book and this is definitely going to be a winner, they're lying to you. And you know they're lying to you because it's about the future. And they can't do it often enough to get you over the hump anyway. And the alternative is to realize that seeking reassurance is a form of hiding, and that the reason this is work is because we have to do it without actual reassurance. It's work because it might not succeed, and we are strong enough to deal with that.
Okay, so nuts and bolts, how do you do it on a day when you feel like, man, I just need someone to tell me I can do it?
First, knowing that I am saying that to myself is the most important part. That realizing that you are looking for reassurance helps you not need to look for reassurance. And the example that I give on stage, which I honestly believe, is no one goes to a trainer and says, teach me how to run the Boston Marathon without getting tired. That's just not an option. The difference between people who finish the Boston Marathon and people who don't are the people who finish figure out where to put the tired. And I believe that productive artists have figured out where to put the need for reassurance, because it's really unlikely that you're going to have an editor, an agent, a spouse, and a team that is always there and that you believe with enough reassurance to keep you going forward.
Ooh, that feels particularly useful. I just really
Serena,
loved
did you have a question?
Bit,
I think you,
near
you
the
wanted,
end,
had something
Tuesdays
you wanted to talk about very specifically.
At the Anthropology Department. It's a little story about a little thinking, brainstorming group you were part of back in business school that met in a very unusual location. And I believe the group leader told you that the reason they met there is because that's the only time you would ever go to that room in the Anthropology Department. And therefore, it would be so associated with the process that you hope to undertake. And I thought that was just beautiful. And I wondered what you would tell writers who are listening today, like how to make that for yourself, like in a practical term, you know, how to do it.
So part of the reason I wrote a book and not a bunch of blog posts is that you can hand a book to somebody and it's complete and it's like this. And the big win for me in this book is if people start groups of three or four the way that Chip Conley started this group in 1983. In 1983, when I got to business school, I was the second youngest person there and I was floundering. And Chip was only a few months older than me. And he put a little note in my mailbox along with three other people and he formed this group and he changed my life. And it's just a weird aside that he's also a best-selling author and he's gone on to do some really cool things. But in that moment, he had the fortitude to say, I see you and I see you and I see you. Let's go on this journey together. Not to reassure each other, but to know that we are not alone. And what I learned from the Anthropology Department part is human brains are easily snapped into various configurations. So I can only write my blog in the WordPress editing window. Anytime I type anywhere else, it doesn't sound like my blog. But once that WordPress window is open, I know why I am here. To write a blog, and I do every time. If I open the window, there's going to be a blog post. It might not be my best blog post, but there will be one. And so I would suggest that writers first find peers, and second, figure out where's the device, where's the screen, where's the window, where's the setting where you only do your work. You don't switch to email, and you don't switch to gossip. You do your work in a Proustian setting that triggers you to do more of it. And I learned that from Isaac Asimov, who I worked with a long time ago. Isaac published 400 books. Serena is catching up really fast. And I said, Isaac, how did you possibly publish 400 books? And he walked me over. He lived near Lincoln Center and he had this little typewriter on this shaky little desk. And he said, every morning I sit at this typewriter at 6:30 and I type until noon. And it doesn't matter if what I type is good or not, I just have to keep typing. And so his subconscious knew that if it was going to be there anyway, it might as well type something good. Couldn't figure out a way to weasel out of it. And that habit of saying, this is my work, these are my tools, that's what plumbers do, that's what jugglers do, and that's what writers should do.
And now I've paid cash money for a program that actually blocks my computer from doing things on the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
So I could reproduce Isaac Asimov's, you know, shaky typewriter.
I told you, I was in a room once with a very well-known Harvard professor, a famous guy who was talking about one of those programs. And someone turned to him and they said, well, why don't you just turn off your Wi-Fi? And he said, because I can't turn off my Wi-Fi. I need my computer to do it for me. So I was reassured that, you know, everyone seems to have that problem.
As you've listened to us talk about author accelerator book coaches in every episode, have you ever thought to yourself, I could do that? If you have, you'll want to look into Author Accelerator's Book Coach Training Program. It's rigorous, thorough, ongoing, and proven to work. Author Accelerator's book coaches are excellent at what they do because they've put in the time to learn to do it right, from editing to book structure to the best ways to provide feedback that helps writers move forward. We think they're great, and maybe you'd like to be one of them. To find out more, head to bookcoaches.com/amwriting.
This has been such a rich conversation. I think we have all the tools. We've created our little community. Not only do we have our little three-way text thing every single day where we award ourselves sort of, you know, our sticker for whether or not we got our work done. We have the hashtag AmWriting Facebook group where that's sort of happening. So we've created that. And as long as we sit down and do what KJ always tells us to do, which is to just open the document, I think we've got the process end of this too. So 400 books, Serena, that's the new that's the new bar, apparently. I think we got to get to work.
Ah, thanks.
I cannot recommend the new book, The Practice, Shipping Creative Work Enough. And Seth, would you like to tell us where people can find you if they would like to check out your blog or find you on social media?
The workshops we run are at akimbo.com, A-K-I-M-B-O. You can read 7,500 blog posts for free at seths.blog or just by typing Seth into Google. I will keep writing until my fingers bleed. And what was the third thing I was going to say? And the third thing I was going to
say,
I don't know, there was a third part of it, but I don't have a third part of it. I would be even happier if someone wrote a book than if they read my book. But if this book helps you publish your book, then it will be a double win.
Excellent. I think that is a great place to leave it. Thank you, everyone who listens. Again, if you want to go to the hashtag AmWriting Facebook group, there is a really cool group of writers there, and we support each other. It's a moderated conversation, so there's no meanies, and really we're all there about in order to support each other's work and try to avoid, you know, reassuring each other too much. Maybe I'll go in there and poke some people today. Maybe I'll go in there and tell them they need to be a little more fearless. Who knows? Until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.